Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, an interview with legendary labor activist Dolores Huerta. She is the subject of a new documentary entitled simply Dolores. It is already screened in Santa Fe and will be at the Guild November 10th through 13th. Dolores Huerta, a native of New Mexico, welcome to the show.
No, it's good to be here.
First, I'd like to start and say congratulations on the film and also having just recently received a Presidential Medal of Freedom Award. What's it like after all these years of struggle for you to capture these high honors?
Well, I believe that the film is a very historical film in many ways because it does talk about the foundation of the United Farm Workers, but also the group that preceded the United Farm Workers, which was the Community Service Organization, where Cesar and I both came out of that organization. So the film is very historical, but at the same time, it's very relevant in terms of today's issues. But it's also very entertaining. The director, Peter Bratt, did a very good job of creating a film, I think, that people enjoy seeing. So much of the film is, there's a lot of issues in the film that are, that you might say, are kind of sad. You know, there's a whole part about Senator Robert Kennedy in the film and his contributions to the Farm Workers Union, but also when his passing. But when you see the film and the way that the director made the film, you come out of that film, I think, feeling motivated and not depressed.
Well, the film suggests that the recognition you're getting now is sort of coming late. And it's pretty explicit about saying that the film suggests it's because you're a female and because you're a Mexican-American female. So do you agree with that? Do you agree that you're getting this recognition late and it's really based on somewhat of a discriminatory attitude toward you?
Well, I think all women, as we have seen in recent headlines, always have a tough time not only getting recognition but being taken seriously. And I do say that was in terms of Cesar Chavez and my partnership in working together the way that we did. Cesar had a lot of respect for my work. He would assign me these huge assignments like, you've got to go to Sacramento and pass all these bills. And even before we started the union, when we were with the Community Service Organization, I lobbied many bills through the state legislature in Sacramento, and including one in the Congress, which was to get rid of the then Bracero program, Public Law 78. And then we're going to go do the boycott in New York City or all over the country, and so we just go do it. And so I had this great support and respect from Cesar.
So I want to come back to the boycott in a second, but you mentioned something that really interests me, and that is organizing, community organizing. And we heard a lot about this when Barack Obama ran for president because he had been a community organizer. But it was never explained exactly what a community organizer does or how do you go about organizing a community. So I wonder if you could expand on that.
Well, we were very lucky, Cesar and myself, that we met this great gentleman named Fred Ross. He's the one that got us both hooked into doing community organizing. And basically, as an organizer, your job is to empower other people and to build leadership in other people. And that's pretty much what you do as a community organizer.
So how do you do that, though? I don't get.
Well, there's actually a process, and with my organization, the Dolores Huerta Foundation, we're doing exactly that, using the same process that we used back in the CSO days that Fred taught us in the United Farm Workers. And basically what we do is we hire an organizer, we train that organizer. That organizer goes into a community and then starts meeting with people in their homes. So the organizing venue is their living room or their yard, if their living room is too small, because we focus on low-income families. Then every organizer has to meet with 200 people. Then they call a meeting of all of the people that they've met with. And it's I always use the word Tupperware because I know women relate to that, where out of the first meeting, you get a second meeting and a third meeting and a fourth meeting. So you get a chain of these meetings. then when you bring everybody together, then they have to vote if they want to form an organization. In the La Fuerte Foundation, we call it Vecinos Unidos, or United Neighbors. Then they have to decide what priorities they're going to work on in their community. What is it, the things that they feel are the most need or that affects them? Then they have to vote on one or two issues, because there's usually a laundry list of issues. But they have to prioritize one or two. Then we make an action plan, and then they have to volunteer to do the work.
So,
volunteering to do the work, and that is how they develop their leadership.
Then
people learn how to do petitions. If it's it's some kind of an ordinance or a resolution that they have to pass, they have to learn how to go to the city council or the board of supervisors. They have to learn how to organize support for the issues that they want to pass. And so it becomes a great opportunity to teach people how to organize to create leadership.
I don't mean to interrupt you, when you were with the farm workers and you were organizing workers toward joining the union, toward striking, toward having a union. So how do you direct the community organization to go in the direction you'd like to see it go?
Well, that's exactly what we did. You know, we would meet with farm workers and we talk about the issues. Okay, we talk about the problem, and this is how the problem was created, and this is what we have to do to solve the problem. And then, this is what we call the crunch. You say to them, "Look, this problem that we have right now is not going to be solved unless you volunteer to solve it. Otherwise, it's never going to change."
I see.
So. And you've got to realize that you've got the power to make this happen. And the only power that you need is the power in your person. But you can't do it by yourself. You've got to, we have to have a lot of people coming together to make this happen. And so then we want you to help us get other people to join with us to create an organization so that we can solve these issues that you're talking about. And it works. And it works. And so you have a very poor people, like farm workers or hotel workers or construction workers, and they come together and they're able to solve the issues. Like, with the United Farm Workers, we were organizing to form a union, and that's what we did. And we before this Delano strike started, Cesar and I organized for 3 years, from 1962 to 1965. So when the workers went on strike, those are workers that were already organized, so they knew what they were doing.
This Week in This American Life.
If you can't get 7 cars in 12 days, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, holy, what, are you kidding me?
A car dealership in Long Island tries to sell its monthly quota of cars, 129 cars. It's not going well.
I want balloons in the showroom. I just don't want one balloon to a car. Balloon the whole freaking place so it looks like a circus.
Will it work? Find out this week.
Sundays at 4 on KUNM.
If you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the phone Dolores Huerta. And Dolores is the subject of a new documentary. It's going to screen here in Albuquerque, November 10th through 13th. And we're talking about her work in organization and her work on her foundation. And I want to come back, Dolores, if I may, just to what you mentioned earlier, the boycott, because I think I read somewhere that Cesar said, organizing farm workers was like organizing grains of sand on the beach, because there was a constant turnover. You weren't subject to the National Labor Relations Act. That agricultural workers had been intentionally excluded from that, so you didn't have any of the benefits or protections. The employer didn't have to deal with you, even if you got a majority. They could fire union workers. They could fire people who were pro union. They didn't. You had a lot of things going against you, but you came up with this idea that, as you were mentioning, this boycott idea. And although we sort of accept it as commonplace today, it was really innovative at the time, was it not?
Yes, it was. I think way back in the 20s and the 30s, I think labor unions had used boycotts. But when they passed the Taft-Hartley law in the 50s, they made boycotting by labor unions illegal.
It could be a mealy enjoined, right?
Could do it,
Right.
Yeah, and the reason that we could do it is because we were not covered under the National Labor Relations Act. And so then we could go to stores and ask people, not only don't buy the grapes, boycott the grapes, but we could also say boycott the store. And that's what made it very easy then for us to be able to get all of these chain stores to take off the grapes. And what we would do is we would, if they were opening up a new store, say in New Jersey, and we had our boycott people in New Jersey and in New York, we would all get together and go to that brand new store in New Jersey and, you know, picket that store and ask people not to buy there. And we would say, we're not going to take off our picket lines until you take the grapes off of all of your chain. We're not going to just picket this one store. We're going to say we want the grapes out of your entire chain. And it was very, very effective. And then we organized people in different communities. So if we had one store that, say, like in New York City, or like Safeway, I think you had Safeways in New Mexico, we want everybody to go to their local Safeway and start picketing that store. So in one chain store, they would have maybe 10 or 20 picket lines on their stores all over wherever they were established.
So that tended to work.
It did.
And it worked very effectively for a while. I'd like to go back to something you also mentioned earlier, and that is your relationship with Cesar. And you know, it was any time you were co-leaders of the union and you were co-founders of the union. And it seems to me like any time you have co-leadership or co-founders, there's going to be disagreements. There's going to be arguments. And then there was this additional complication, which is that you actually became very close. I think had a long-term relationship with his younger brother, I think Richard, and you had four children with Richard. So you actually ended up being like a family, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Very, very much so. I did. I guess we did complicate that relationship quite a bit when Richard and I got together. You know, we continued working together. I mean, that, you know, we had a few bumps there, but we continued working together. The one thing about Cesar and myself, we're both Aries. He was born March 31st. I was born April the 10th. And so we had similar kinds of temperaments in some respect. The one thing is that we played off of each other's ideas very well. And we would discuss them, and we would argue about them. You know, we weren't always in lockstep. And I think sometimes people couldn't understand that, how we could get into a heated discussion about something, and yet we'd come out of it, and sometimes he would win, sometimes I would win the argument. Yeah, but we would continue working together and working on that particular tactic or mission or whatever. And sometimes people ask me, well, do you have regrets? And I say, well, sometimes my regrets are that I didn't fight harder for an idea that I had, or an idea that that I thought was wrong, you know, that I didn't fight harder.
He seemed,
I let myself be quieted, you know. I think we women have that problem all the time, is that we either don't let our voices be heard, even when we have instincts and we have ideas that we think are good ideas, and sometimes we give up too soon.
Well, he seemed to become the public face of the United Farm Workers, and I'm wondering if that was an actual decision or did it just happen that way?
No, it actually was, and of course, when we started the movement, you know, I come from a middle class background. I don't come from a farm worker background.
Yeah.
Cesar came from a
You were college educated too, and so I think Cesar dropped out of junior high or something.
Yeah, well, he actually never went to junior high.
He
only went to the eighth grade. And that's because, you know, they were migrant farm workers, and they never had that opportunity to go to school. You know, they had to feed the family. You know, the Chavez family had their own farm in Yuma, but they lost the farm during the Depression because the father couldn't get a loan from the bank. And this is a part of the history of discrimination, of course, against Mexicans in the United States. You know, the other white farmers were able to get loans, but because he was Mexican-American, he couldn't get a loan. And so they had to give up the farm and then become migrant workers. And his dad was Librado, was his name. He was already in his 50s when they lost the farm. And for farm work, for a person to be 50 years old as a farm worker is pretty difficult because the work is so strenuous and hard. So all of the kids were, you know, had to go out there and help feed the family. And so, but Cesar was a genius. And the other thing about Cesar, he's self-educated because he always had a book under his arm. He was always reading. Cesar was always educating himself. He was never without a book, never without a book.
You know, I had this opportunity to actually meet him. I had taken on a case for the farm workers when I was a teacher, a law teacher in Columbus, Ohio. And I was told he wanted to meet me to thank me for this victory we had. It was one of these boycott cases. And, you know, as I'm sure you know, every time there was picketing, there was an injunction brought. And so I handled that case, and I met him, and it wasn't a long meeting, but he seemed to me to be almost someone. He seemed very humble. He seemed to not want the limelight, but he had this unbelievable charisma about him. He was very soft-spoken. Is that your impression of him too?
Oh, exactly. In fact, I remember once we were in a meeting, and people were yelling. We were going into a meeting of farm workers, and people were yelling, "Viva Chavez!" And I saw him wince, and I said, "What happened, Cesar?" And he said, I really don't like that." He said, "For them to do that, to say Viva Chavez," he said, and then he said, "And I know some of them people that are shouting Viva Chavez are the ones that refuse to give me a house meeting."
So, it wasn't that he wanted the glory. It's that you two decided that he would be the face of the union.
Right. Well, actually, we talked about that. You know, he brought it up. And, of course, as I said before, I came from a middle-class background, and I just wasn't sure how much I could really offer to the movement and that we were forming, that we were organizing. And he said to me, and I said, "Cesar, gee, I'm not really sure that I'll have that much to offer because, you know, we made this plan. We're going to start doing the house meetings and we're just starting this organization." And he said, I just remember this. He said, "If the workers could have done it without you," he said, "they would already be organized." Okay. So that kind of gave me the self-confidence that I needed. And then this is interesting. Of course, I did not have my feminist lens on in those days, and even going to work with farm workers, because I grew up, my mother was a businesswoman, a leader in the community, always a dominant person in our family, because she was also, had divorced my dad, so was a single mother for many years. And so I always saw my mother as a leader, and saw many women leaders in our community. But when Cesar said to me, "Well, one of us has to be the spokesperson for the organization," then he said, "I think it should be me." And I said, "Oh, of course." But looking back on that conversation, and now, as I said to you, I'm on the board of the Feminist Majority, I probably would have said, "Okay, Cesar, you be the spokesperson sometimes, and I'll be the spokesperson."
But you actually, I mean, the movie shows you being the spokesperson sometimes. I mean, in New York leading the boycott.
Yeah, definitely. When I went to New York City, people in New York had no clue who Cesar Chavez was. You know, we had to introduce Cesar to the East Coast because outside of California, nobody really knew who he was. This is part of the work that we did on the boycott, was introducing Cesar to the public.
If you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the phone Dolores Huerta. Dolores is the subject of a new movie called Simply Dolores. It will be in Albuquerque at the Guild November 10th through 13th. And you bring up another interesting thing. You've actually alluded to it earlier in our conversation, and that is the farm workers, and you in particular, and actually Cesar too, sort of got into Democratic politics, and you sort of aligned yourselves with the progressive wing of the Democrats, and specifically Bobby Kennedy. I remember these shots of Bobby Kennedy going to Cesar when he was fasting, but what I really remember is you being on the stage, having just thanked Bobby Kennedy. He walks off the stage, and that's when he's assassinated. That must have been a truly frightening moment for you, and a sad moment for you.
Devastating, I think, is the word. It was a devastating moment. I think not only for me personally, but for the country,
and certainly for your cause.
Yes.
But you know what the farm workers. I want to ask a broad question about the farm workers and the unionization, because at some point the farm workers had organized about 50% or so of the workers they wanted to organize, but you had to either grow or die because the benefits you were getting the farm workers made those growers non-competitive with the other growers.
Oh,
and
that's not true.
You
that's
don't agree
true.
With that.
No, that's not true. I think that's their line.
That's their line.
That's their line, but actually they did very well. The thing is that they made so much profit. In one of the areas where they were able actually to give the workers benefits without even having an increase in their payout is by eliminating the labor contractors. They had these middlemen, which are by the way back into business, and what they paid the labor contractors was anywhere from 25% to 35%. You know, so by eliminating the labor contractors, they were actually able to increase the wages of the workers and even give money for a medical plan and a pension plan. The growers make incredible profits. You know, they make incredible profits, and by eliminating the middleman, and actually when you had the farm labor force out there, the workers help them manage the farms, because a lot of these growers are, we have agribusiness here in California, so you have these absentee landowners basically. I remember the great Congressman Phil Burton saying he had more growers in his district in San Francisco, in the business district, than any of the other Congress people had, you know. So it wasn't that they were non-competitive. It's just, and it goes back, and if you see the film, and I do mention this in the film, when Caesar and I first discussed about organizing the union, and he said we will never see a national union in our lifetimes because the growers are too rich, they're too powerful, and they're too racist.
So you think that's why the union in the end didn't succeed?
No, what happened, it was all political. It was all political because once we had we passed the Agricultural Labor Relations Act, which made
in California, right?
In California,
right?
But then, and we were doing great when Jerry Brown was governor. But then, when his term was up, and this guy Duke Majan, a Republican, got elected, then they got rid of all of the pro worker staff that they had in the ALRB. They had a general counsel who was very much anti-union, a Republican. Many of the victories that we had, lawsuits that we had won against the growers, were settled like for 10 cents on the dollar.
In other words, they weren't enforcing the act.
No, they weren't enforcing the act, and they were actually working against farm workers. And so, and then we had the Teamsters that came in 1973 when we had, and that's all in the film, by the way, we had 100,000 farm workers under contract. And, within a month after that Teamster invasion, when they came in and signed sweetheart contracts with the growers, then we were
sweetheart
down
contracts that were much more
like
favorable.
20,000.
Sweetheart
Pardon
means
me?
Much. Sweetheart contracts means much more favorable contracts with the growers than you were doing.
And so, and then they walked away from the contracts.
And then
so
they walked
away.
They
signed those contracts to get rid of the UFW, and then they walked away from them.
I see. So it was a cut. So. You're saying that it was a combination of the politics, basically not in...
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a conspiracy, actually, between Richard Nixon, the president of the United States, Frank Fitzsimmons, the head of the Teamsters Union, and Alan Grant, the head of the Farm Bureau Federation.
And they were very explicit about not wanting the farm workers to unionize, right?
That's right. And it's all political because, again, the farm workers and I think our supporter Bobby Kennedy had a lot to do with that. You know, because they saw that we could be very influential in the political arena. And that came back from the community service organization, because in CSO, which preceded the United Farm Workers, that was what we learned from Fred Ross, that you had to go out there and you had to register people to vote, and you had to get people, turn people out to vote, you know. And then we had to support progressive candidates, you know, like Robert Kennedy, like Jerry Brown.
So we're nearing the end of the show, Dolores, and so I'd like to get your take on, where the farm workers stand today. I mean, from what I've read, they're, if anything, worse off than they were, relatively speaking, in the 60s and 70s. But I'd like your take on that.
Oh, they're not worse off. I mean, they're not worse off. I mean, the laws that we pass, particularly in California. Well, let me start at the national level.
Okay.
Okay. You were one of the boycott supporters, okay? People like yourself and all of those that picketed stores and didn't eat grapes or lettuce or drink yellow wine. The farm workers today, all over the United States of America, have toilets in the fields.
Yeah. They're...
And they have cold drinking water, and they have to have safety standards. And every farm worker, no matter whether he's a citizen, a resident, or undocumented, cannot... They have to have these benefits for those workers, and they cannot be put to work in any place where their life or their safety could be endangered. And that is a national; those are national laws. Farm workers who are migrant workers, if they travel over 150 miles to get to their work, they have to provide them with food, and they have to provide them with shelter and pay the cost of the transportation, okay?
Okay.
So these are national benefits that the workers have. In California, the farm workers have unemployment insurance, you know, and they have the right to organize. And all farm workers are covered. Oh, I should mention this on the national level, too. But all farm workers are covered under minimum wage, even if they're undocumented. Even if they're undocumented, all farm workers are covered under minimum wage standards. And in California, all of the farm workers under all the benefits that the United Farm Workers has, the medical plan, the pension plan, any benefits from the contracts that they sign with the growers, all farm workers are covered whether they're documented or not. And if they're discriminated on the job, they're covered. And these are laws that we have in California. And the only two places where we have the right to organize is California and Hawaii because of the Longshoremen's Union over there in Hawaii. So farm workers are better off today. What we see now with the Trump administration is that they're going to be bringing in a lot of contract workers, foreign workers. I think they're just approving something like 200,000 workers, which is going to decimate the local farm labor force. And, of course, that's why they have increased the deportations, because they want to bring in workers as slaves, basically, under these foreign worker programs.
The guest worker programs you're talking about?
Yeah, the guest worker programs, uh-huh.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank my guest today, Dolores Huerta. She is the subject of a new documentary. It's called simply Dolores.
And they want information about Dolores Huerta. It's DoloresHuerta.org.
Thanks also to my engineer, Marshall Broyles. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available wherever you get podcasts. Archives of my past shows are at stevenspitz.com. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.